This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 12 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods, who's on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Well, this week we are returning to our series focusing on other planets orbiting our sun. And this time, it's going to be the largest such planet, which, of course, is Jupiter. So we'll be talking about what that actually means and take a look at the many other distinguishing features of one of our most visible celestial objects in the sky. But first, let's knock off a couple of updates, and Steve, why don't you get us started?
By now, listeners know we take great joy in announcing Canadian achievements, which often slips under the mainstream media, and today I've got two such. Well, let's make it three such updates. First off, I'd like to feature two Canadian scientists who have recently been awarded the 2024 Norwegian Kavli Prize in astrophysics for their groundbreaking work on the discovery and characterization of extrasolar planets and, here it is, their atmospheres. Along with international recognition, handsome medals, and prestigious scrolls, they each received $1 million. Dr. David Charbonneau was born in Ottawa and obtained his Bachelor of Science degree in Mathematics, Physics, and Astronomy from the University of Toronto. In 2001, he earned his PhD in Astronomy from Harvard University. Charbonneau pioneered the use of space-based observatories to undertake the first studies of the atmosphere of distant worlds. And in 2001, he used the Hubble Space Telescope to study directly the chemical makeup of the atmosphere of an exoplanet. And in 2005, led the team that used the Spitzer Space Telescope to make the first direct detection of the light emitted by an exoplanet. Now, his co-worker is Dr. Sarah Seeger, holder of the Order of Canada. She was born in Toronto, earning her Bachelor of Science degree in Mathematics and Physics and her PhD from Harvard University as well. She is currently a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and her doctoral thesis developed theoretical models of atmospheres on extrasolar planets, and as such, she is worldwide renowned for her work in that area. So congratulations to Dr. Charbonneau and Seeger. And my third update today, Tim, is with regard to the recent awarding of the Nobel Prize in Physics, jointly won by Dr. John Hopfield at Princeton University and Dr. Jeffrey Hinton from the University of Toronto. The laureates won their work in artificial intelligence, specifically creating neural networking algorithms. And it's noted that Dr. Hinton was born in London and obtained his PhD from the University of Edinburgh before deciding to emigrate to Canada to pursue his academic career in 1987. He was immediately then appointed as a fellow of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. And you know, Tim, that's an organization I dare say is unknown to most. Certainly, I'd never heard of it. Known as the godfather of AI, Dr. Hinton chose Canada over the United States, stating, quote, "I came to Canada because I like the society here and because they have very good funding for basic research. It's not very much money, but they give it for basic curiosity-driven research as opposed to big applications." And so a big Space Talks congratulations to Dr. Hinton and to Canadian culture fostering research, which is a phrase you don't often hear.
So thanks for that, Steve. And now it's time to get started on today's focus, which is Jupiter. Jupiter is among the brightest objects that you can see in the night sky. In fact, only the Sun, the Moon, Venus, and Mars, and just one star, Sirius, shine brighter. Now, if you happen to live south of the equator, you can add one more star to this list, the white supergiant Canopus. As a small sidebar here, Steve, Sirius is 25 times brighter than our sun, but Canopus is a whopping 10,000 times brighter, so you can take an educated guess as to which of the two is closer to us, but I digress.
Speaking of brightness, one must ask as to why is Jupiter so intrinsically bright? After all, it's not a star, it's just a reflecting object.
Well, at its closest, Jupiter's elliptical orbit actually approaches to within 588 million kilometers, which is a lot closer than when it's furthest away from us at some 967 million kilometers. In relative terms, that's pretty close, and so a lot of sunlight is actually reflected off this big planet. Now, what might be surprising to some, however, is another reason for Jupiter's brightness, which is the composition of its outer gases. Although mostly it's comprised of hydrogen and helium, here's the thing. There's a considerable amount of ammonia crystals, and they are, in fact, highly reflective.
So, with regard to reflectivity, I believe that we're talking about something called albedo, which is a term used to indicate the fraction of light reflected by a surface. Albedo values are influenced by factors such as atmospheric composition, surface materials, and cloud cover. Now, we all know how bright a full moon appears, but it actually has a low albedo of 0.12, which means 12%. That means it only reflects 12% of the sunlight which actually hits it. On the other hand, our Earth has an albedo of 0.30, which means it reflects 30% of the sunlight. So, if you were on the moon, gazing at the full Earth, you would see a far more spectacular sight than the other way around because of Earth's relative size and brightness.
Aha, and not to be outdone in the realm of brightness is Jupiter with an albedo of 0.52, which means it reflects 52% of sunlight. And you know, Steve, I've got to say that all too often I learn that what's going on in space is not actually intuitive. Not that it should be, I suppose, but check this out. We know that Jupiter is an enormous planet which dwarfs our own Earth.
Just a second, Tim. I think I hear the approaching footsteps of an analogy. So if I'm right, lay it on us.
Okay, so if you were to scale this down and represent the Earth's size as being one basketball, you'd have to put down 10 more basketballs to represent the diameter of Jupiter. And it also takes much longer than the Earth to circumnavigate the Sun, which, of course, makes sense if you think of Kepler's third law of planetary motion, which we've discussed in a previous episode. But that aside, it takes Jupiter about 12 Earth years to make its one trip around the Sun. And with regard to planetary rotation, well, we know that one day on Earth takes 24 hours. But what about Jupiter, which has the shortest day of any planet in the solar system? So you've got this enormous planet spinning around in just 10 hours for one complete circumnavigation. And that's what one day is, 10 hours of our Earth time.
For comparative purposes, at the equator, the rotational speed of our Earth is 1,670 kilometers per hour. So that means if you're standing on the equator, you're actually moving at 1,670 kilometers per hour. Of course, you don't know it. If you go a little bit further north, such as here in BC, our rotational spin is slower at 1,075 kilometers per hour. But, and here it is, if you were on the surface of Jupiter, you'd be rotating at a blistering speed of 45,300 kilometers per hour. And historically, Tim, Jupiter has been turning heads for a long time. And being so visible, the ancient Babylonians recorded sightings and recorded it around 800 years BCE.
I really love the history of this. And if you move along historically from that time, Jupiter got named by the Romans. However, I don't want to just toss that nugget aside too quickly. Here's the thing. Other planets like Neptune have a name that is linked in some fashion to the individuals that first spotted the planet. And to this day, we're still assigning names to objects in the sky to honor individuals, as we've talked about before. In the case of Jupiter, the story is really worth some attention. In essence, the Romans integrated their observations of the cosmos into their religious practices, believing that the heavens and the gods were deeply interconnected. The planets and celestial bodies played, in fact, a significant role in the Roman state religion and their mythology. So Romans believed that the movements and positions of celestial bodies, including planets, had direct implications for earthly affairs.
While the Romans sort of appropriated the Greeks in naming their gods, the word Jupiter is actually derived from two words which translate to sky father. The Romans made a strong connection between astronomy and religion, which was a fundamental aspect of their culture and society, whereas we look at the sky with a sense of wonder and awe and curiosity. The Romans, however, read the same sky as being an integral part of their life and fate.
Now, of course, today we're not conflating gods and planets, but we are very interested in Jupiter and have been for so long a time that it's now been 50 years since humans started sending spacecraft to get a better look at the planet. Now, even though you and I lived through those early explorations of Jupiter, it's still a long time ago, I'm afraid, and it's hard to reimagine how the planners, scientists, and builders of those early spacecrafts must have felt. Now, keep this in mind. It was in 1972 that Pioneer 1 launched for a first mission to Jupiter, and that was just 3 years after Neil Armstrong had set foot on the moon. But Jupiter, think of it, Jupiter is hundreds of millions of kilometers further away than the moon. And there were actually two Pioneer missions sent to Jupiter back then, Pioneer 10 in 1972, and then followed the next year by Pioneer 11. Those were the first two missions from NASA to cross the asteroid belt, and upon arrival, they sent back and transmitted some amazing images. Eventually, Pioneer 10 passed to within 120,000 kilometers. Of course, they were measuring things like radiation and many other aspects, and not surprisingly, they also zeroed in on the Great Red Spot on Jupiter. We all know that one.
Everyone was pretty curious about that big spot, which apparently is a huge storm and has been raging for centuries. And how big is it? Well, you could fit the Earth inside the boundaries of that one storm. Incidentally, though, we've heard of Martian dust storms, which can and do cover solar panels on the rover and other Martian space probes, but they pale in comparison. The driving force of the red storm actually comes from internal heating within Jupiter, whereas the dust storms on Mars are driven by solar heating. So the thin Martian atmosphere limits the duration of their dust storms to days and weeks, unlike the Great Red Spot, where the thick atmosphere allows for centuries of turbulence. Say, that reminds me of an old 1990s advertising by an HVAC company, and that advertisement went, "Hey, it's hard to stop a train." And so I guess it's hard to stop that red spot.
So the red spot, it's massive in size, but it actually is limited to a corner of the giant planet. Whereas the dust storms on Mars, they actually can affect the entire planet. But let's not forget other spacecraft such as Voyagers 1 and 2 and the Galileo orbiter, which have been sent to fly by Jupiter. And more recently, the Galileo and Juno missions have orbited the planet and studied, amongst other things, the magnetic fields, the radiation levels, and the atmospheres. So we've been building up a fairly robust understanding of the planet, which is quite impressive when you think about it, when you think about how far away Jupiter is from the Earth. And there's one more mission here, Steve, that we've got to mention because it's current.
So I believe you're referring to the Europa Clipper mission. And oh yes, it's current, being launched just months ago in October of 2024. Although one might well surmise with the name of Europa that it was a mission sponsored by the European Space Agency, you'd be wrong. Europa is a NASA project headed for its namesake, the moon Europa, which was first discovered in 1610 and is just one of 95 moons orbiting Jupiter. However, don't hold your breath because Europa won't arrive until 2030.
That's a long time, Stephen. It's a really interesting route that this spacecraft is taking. It's going to take 6 years. The spacecraft will travel 2.9 billion kilometers. And for those of you at home keeping score, the current distance between Earth and Jupiter is just north of 600 million kilometers. The Europa Clipper, however, is going to fly nearly five times the current distance in order to get to Jupiter faster, Steve. That's right. It's going to take the fast route, but the long route. It's hard to understand, but the math is fascinating.
So is this like driving further on a freeway to a destination, but getting there faster because you didn't take the shorter goat path?
So that's exactly right. Absolutely. And it's also going to use less fuel, which is critical for the mission. And it's going to do this by taking a slingshot around the Earth and Mars in order to gain speed and adjust its trajectory. The first slingshot will be around Mars in 2025, and then it will return to slingshot around the Earth in 2026. So, Steve, this is indeed a case of rocket science.
Well, the important science actually takes place in 2030 when the Clipper arrives on scene near Europa. Although the Clipper will circumnavigate 49 times around Europa, and I find that hard to believe, even though Maxwell Smart wouldn't, but in one of those flybys, the Clipper will come to just within 25 kilometers of its surface. And even more incredible, I suppose, is the reason to go to all this trouble to this specific moon. After all, there's 94 others to choose from.
Ah, but Europa is quite the special place, Steve. Consider this. Each and every day, Europa generates enough oxygen to meet the needs of 1 million people. Now, mind you, that would be 1 million very cold people because the surface temperature on Europa is just minus 160 to minus 260 degrees Celsius. Nevertheless, Steve, as cold as it might be, below the icy surface, there's considerable evidence that underneath that ice is liquid water, the stuff that we drink.
There's indeed evidence of the subsurface ocean of water based on multiple lines of evidence, including surface features such as cracks and ridges, tidal heating effects, and the evidence of disruptions in Jupiter's magnetic fields. So while scientists are highly confident, direct confirmation from Europa will clinch the deal. Tim, you've done the research on this one. Just how will the Clipper do the math on this possible ocean of water?
Well, the spacecraft is carrying some pretty neat tools that are going to help get that job done. And I made a list of them. I'm just going to rattle them off for us, for the audience here. Okay, so it's going to be listening to the ice by emitting radio waves that'll measure reflections, which can then reveal details regarding the thickness of the ice and whether there might be trapped water slush or salt. It's also got a tool that will sniff the atmosphere, listening for or smelling for clues of certain molecules that could detect faint traces of leaking water vapor and other gases. It's also measuring Europa's gravitational anomalies to determine the hidden shape and size of this apparent ocean. Now, measuring the Europa's surface temperature can also help to determine warm spots, which in turn would indicate the movement of liquid water. And finally, yes, there's that good old Scotsman James Clerk Maxwell who determined that moving magnets produce electricity and moving electrical currents produce magnetism, and they'll be detecting that as well.
All that being said, Tim, who wants to wait 6 years for that batch of information? Why don't we just go there ourselves in our imagination, which we shall right after this short break for station identification.
Steve, we've been stuck in our home-based studios for a long time, and only once have we recorded from the wonderful CKVS studio in Salmon Arm, and yet here we are in season three. We're long overdue for a road trip, don't you think? And what better time than now when we're focusing on Jupiter, a planet that I've always wanted to visit?
And so, Tim, from the depths of laboratories in our own industrial research facility, I've completed the finishing touches on our starship Curiosity, and I hasten to add, our venture won't end as it did for a certain Thelma and Louise.
Well, that's good news, Steve, because for the longest time, I've been told that this enormous planet, so visible in the night sky, is nothing more than a giant windbag, a globe of gas, and a puffed-up planet wannabe. Frankly, it never really added up to me. For instance, how come a big gust of solar wind hasn't just come along and blown away that oversized balloon way into deep space? Just what is going on up there now? And you say you can actually get us there? Well, let's get on with it. We'll start a recording, and at the end, we'll replay the edited highlights for our Space Talks audience. What do you say, Steve? Make it so.
Roger that, Tim.
Greetings, Earthlings. This is Captain Tim Woods reporting live from the bridge of the starship Curiosity. And with me is my trusty co-pilot, First Officer Stephen Lowry.
Hello, everyone. Today, we're embarking and recording a journey completely out of this world, quite literally, as we plan to head to the center of Jupiter.
That's right, Lowry. A place where no man, woman, or even space squirrel has gone before.
Space squirrel? Excuse me, Commander. Are you thinking of Rocky the Flying Squirrel?
You never know. Now, for those of you who are curious, what's so special about Jupiter, you ask?
Oh, just a little thing like perhaps being the largest planet in our solar system. It's got more moons than you can shake a space stick at. I think we said 95. And it's made mainly of gas.
Yes, gas. Which means it's basically a gigantic floating whoopee cushion in space.
Can you imagine the sound should it get squeezed?
Indeed. But now, how are we going to navigate to the center of this massive gas ball?
Just a second here, Captain. Allow me to make some adjustments. Oh well, in our ultra-realistic, totally legitimate space adventure, we've got the Curiosity equipped with the latest in theoretical science fiction technology, complete with deflector shields designed, of course, by the lowest bidder. Therefore, we're going to fearlessly descend through the dense stormy clouds and layers of hydrogen and helium. We're going to throw caution to the Jupiter's winds, if you will.
That's a great idea. And let's not forget the giant red spot, Jupiter's giant storm, that's been raging for over 300 years. We are about to become the first people to give it a close-up inspection. In fact, with the windshield wipers on full, I can start to see it now looming large in our amazing dome viewing station. Just look at those intricate cloud formations swirling around down there, and the colors are amazing.
Oh, exalted Captain, you've no doubt noticed the colors are more intense at the cloud tops. Surface winds are whipping up organic chemicals, and according to my Mark 7 tricorder, wait a sec. 20 miles, we'll I'm getting a reading of pH-3 molecules, and that means there's phosphine and some other hydrocarbons. And if I'm not mistaken, according to page 75 of my manual, that means exposure to the sun's ultraviolet light is causing a chemical reaction, producing those amazing tones of reds, browns, and yellows.
Right you are, second in command. And my spectrometer reading is saying that there's also an abundance of ammonia ice crystals present, and those will be combining with the rest of the soup to create that reddish tinge that we're seeing. So, higher clouds are reflecting more sunlight, making the clouds seem brighter. What a show! I just wish everyone listening could be here and see it for themselves. Now, just a minute, Steve. I want to get a couple of shots with my Polaroid.
Polaroid? Ah, of course. You're referring to that photographic device developed by Dr. Edwin Land, who also invented polarized sunglasses and helped to develop optical lenses for the U-2 spy plane.
You're not getting paid by the word, Lowry. Now, once we've descended another 100 kilometers or so into the atmosphere, we should be seeing some startling differences, so get ready for it. Be prepared.
Commander Woods, the temperature at these higher levels is a bone-numbing minus 145 degrees Celsius, but wait a sec. The thermometer is beginning to spring upwards.
Looks like our frosty welcome is quickly coming to an end, number two. Look at that gauge. But we're over 1,000 degrees C and it's getting hotter every second. Hey, did you close those window blinds?
Well, of course, Captain. And I've got curiosity adapting to the associated rising pressure. You know, on Earth's surface, the weight of the atmosphere is defined as being 1 bar. Seconds ago, we were 10 kilometers above the cloud tops and we had a reading of 2 bars. Now, at 50 kilometers below the clouds, we're reading 10 bars. And wait a sec, as we continue to descend, I'm getting a reading of 1,000 bars of atmosphere.
Well, don't worry about that, Lowry. I've seen more bars during a certain weekend in Vancouver, but, you know, that story another time.
Captain, oh my Captain, we're now 15,000 kilometers below Jupiter's cloud tops. The atmosphere is reading a staggering 2 million bars. Uh-oh, look, something's happening to the hydrogen gas.
Ah, it's just as I and the Magic 8-Ball predicted. This is more than just a walk in the park, you know. We're picking up signs of a new environment. And wait a second. What are we encountering? It looks, it's a liquid metal, and from what I can determine, it's liquid hydrogen. Our spacecraft is now moving through what used to be a gas, but is now molten metal, and there's no surface to this planet, as Spock might say. Fascinating. And now, about the core, Lowry. We're nearly there, but I don't see what we're up against. Have you got a guess?
Apologies, Supreme Commander, but Jupiter's core remains a cosmic mystery. Perhaps it's a composition of rock, metallic hydrogen, and ice, or maybe it's a torrid ball of heavy elements. Who knows?
Well, it sounds like we don't know, but it's a solid core surrounded by layers of liquid metal and gas. I mean, does that sound a little bit like a cosmic DQ parfait?
Ooh, I like that, a Jupiter a la mode. But I fear that as we approach the core, temperatures could reach up to 24,000 degrees Celsius, far more than Earth's 7,000 degrees. I don't think our shields will take that, Captain.
I believe you're right, old chum. Those temperatures and pressures are just too much. I think we're going to have to conclude our mission to the core, well, perhaps another time.
Oh, excellent call. After all, discretion is the better part of valor, as they say. It was fun while it lasted. We didn't become Louise and Thelma. I'll set the coordinates for home.
Good call. Make it so. And end this recording of our intrepid, if what, misguided venture.
And so this is First Officer Stephen Lowry, based in Salmon Arm.
And self-appointed Commander for Life Tim Woods aboard the spaceship Curiosity, also from Brentwood Bay, signing off. Stay curious, stay tuned, and we'll see you next time on Space Talks.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?